All right. This is Seth Koch with the Southern Oral History Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I am here with Alma Blunt, director of the Hart Program in Leadership at the Sanford School for Public Policy at Duke University. We're here in her office on the campus of Duke University, and the date is July 10th, 2014. Professor Blunt, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, we often like to start our interviews just with a little bit of life history. I understand that your family has a very long history in Western North Carolina. Can you tell me a little bit about your family background?
Sure. My family has a long history in Western North Carolina, but started in Eastern North Carolina. So my family, I should be more versed in my family history than I am, but it's I am a direct descendant of William Blunt, who was the first governor of the Tennessee Territory, and then his brother was Wiley Blunt, who was one of the first governors of what became the state of Tennessee, and those folks were descendants of four Blunt brothers who came over here from Soddington, England in 1663, and so they arrived in the Albemarle Sound area, and ever since they kind of gravitated across the state. And William Blunt was born in Bertie County. And so, you know, even though I grew up in Asheville, and my family's been there since my great-grandmother's generation, as I was growing up, everybody always talked about Eastern North Carolina and Raleigh and Blunt Street in Raleigh and, you are the direct descendant of this gentleman who signed the Constitution. That's William Blunt. And, you know, so I've heard the family brag about the family my whole life, but I it's kind of pathetic. Even at this point, I don't know lots of details about it because I've never really taken the time to sit down and read about it in depth. But my other people in my family have, my sisters have, and my dad. And, but I grew up in, my family gravitated across the state. My great-grandfather and my grandfather had a naval stores business. Do you know what that is?
Why don't you tell me?
Well, it's probably supplied lots of different things, but what my family was in, their business was a turpentine business. So back before oil became really big, things that were derived from pine trees, the various products, including turpentine, that were derived from pine trees, were hugely important in industry and in World War I. And so my family had a vast naval store business that ran across North Carolina into Tennessee, down through Georgia, and down through Florida. And somewhere along those lines, the Blunts teamed up with the Monroe's family. So it's actually my great grandmother on my great grandmother, who was not a Blunt, who produced Alma Blunt, my grandmother, who married E.B. Blunt, who was the Blunt. But she's the one that had the land in Asheville. So as I grew up, I kept hearing about the Blunts, but I also heard about the French side of my family, the Monroe's side, and those are the folks who bought the property in Asheville. So when I was growing up, actually now that I look back on it, I feel like I had an amazingly gifted upbringing, because I grew up on this spread with a lot of land, and that just was the normal thing. I thought everybody got to do that, and then I realized that's not true. And my family at that point wasn't wealthy. They were we were really actually pretty poor, dirt poor, all in a tiny little cabin, all seven of us. But that sense of being deeply rooted in the state comes from all sides of my family. It's kind of a nice feeling. I grew up with it. I didn't think twice. I thought that's the way it was for everybody.
Right.
Come to find out that's not true.
Now, was that process of learning that's not true something that you sort of were exposed to at a young age and in a moment, or is it something that just over the course of reflecting you've realized that you were lucky in some way or another?
I think what a great question. See, you ask good questions.
Thank you.
You're a good fit for what you're doing. Boy, that is a great question. I actually think it has taken me a long time to kind of figure that out. And I think it's been a combination of life experience and just getting getting older and seeing, I don't know, you know, it's like anybody, I mean, when I was growing up, I wanted to get the heck out of Asheville. Asheville wasn't anything like what it is now. It's just a dying city. I wanted to get away from my family. My family, you know, had gone through really hard times, having come on both sides of my family, come from wealth and then losing their wealth through various things. Those are whole other stories. But by the time I was a child, the family, my dad's family had, my dad had no money, and he had all these children and no money, and everybody was just kind of crammed into this little cabin on the side of a mountain where the roof leaked. And so I just wanted to get away from that. I wanted to get away from North Carolina. I wanted to get away from Asheville. And as much as I adored my family, which I still do to this day, I really wanted to get away from my family. Part of that is just probably being a teenager.
Yeah.
But for me, frankly, you know, it was even a disappointment. As much as I love UNC and loved being able to go to school there, I wanted to get away from UNC too. I just wanted to get away from the state,
right.
But it wasn't an option. It was a big enough deal that I was able to get partial scholarship and go to UNC. And,
right.
You know, so it's only over time that I've realized, wow, not everybody has this deep, rich sense of really being anchored in not only a very wonderful and rich and convoluted and kind of tragic, but certainly very interesting family history, but rooted in the history of a state, you know. And there's really, and that's I continue to kind of be astounded by that my family's all over the state.
Yeah.
And in lots of different ways. I mean, I've traveled around, and my family was very involved with slavery. That's a whole nother story. And parts of my family and their whole communities, and I'm white. I can go to certain parts of North Carolina, and there are very large extended families of African Americans that have this, we share the same last name. And when you start asking people about their family history, they're connected to the Blunt family. It was connected to, you know, such and such farmers and plantation owners. And so, you know, that's another part. I don't really know that, but
yeah.
But it's a good feeling that, and overall, I feel privileged in a way I don't deserve to have that connection with a, you know, a family that's very grounded. It's a grounded feeling.
It's a very the demographic of Bertie County and Buncombe County are, I feel like you could tell a lot about North Carolina if you sort of average the two of them, maybe.
No, isn't that so true? Yeah. I will have to tell you one just quickly. One time a person sent me a photograph. I have this photograph in my belongings at home. This was maybe about 20 years ago. This person was an antiques furniture dealer in Winston-Salem. I didn't know her. I got this package in the mail, Alma Blunt, my address in Durham. Could you please, I opened it up, and there are all these pictures of this beautiful African-American family with lots of different family pictures from, look like the early 1920s and the 1930s. And one picture was maybe, I don't know, about 3x2, and it was a picture of a lovely young woman who looked like maybe she was in her early 20s, leaning out over a porch, holding onto the porch rails with a huge smile on her face, very happy, and underneath the photo it said Alma Blunt. And so she said, this photo has your name on it. Is this you? I found this in the drawer of an old dresser that I bought from somebody, and no, I can't track down. These are precious, precious photos. It looks like they came from Durham. Your address is Durham. Please help me find the home for these photos. And I called the dealer, and we talked, and I tried really hard to find. I couldn't find. I drove around. I talked to people. I still am to this day haunted. Isn't that interesting? That's just a really little side thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Anyway.
So you pursued a degree at University of North Carolina. Before then, did you have any experiences that you recall as a high schooler in Asheville? Where did you go to high school?
I went to Reynolds High School, which is a county school.
And what was that like?
It was, you know what? It was, again, this is one of those things, and now that I'm older, I can see how blessed I was to have, be in a high school with teachers and a principal and people who, you know, guidance counselors and people who ran the athletic program, people who really cared about us and were, I would call them good salt of the earth mountain people, a lot of Southern Baptists. My family's Catholic. That's a whole nother story too, but I, in, when I was in high school, I excelled. I did well academically, and I, you know, was president of my student body and all that kind of stuff. But I couldn't wait to get out of there. I thought, this is, this place sucks. These people, this place is not sophisticated. I wanted the big time. So I don't think I appreciated it as much as I do now. And right. I just went back to my 40th reunion. I was asked to be one of the two speakers at my 40th reunion last year, and I just went back and got to see a lot, a good number of the people that I went to high school with, and it was really fascinating. And it made me realize, again, how blessed I was, because honestly, when I went to high school, people cared. People cared, you know, you weren't able to, nobody got away with a whole lot. You know, people were very attentive, and that's a whole other conversation about the differences between Catholicism and the Southern Baptist tradition, and you know, some constraints that were part of the culture when I was growing up. I didn't really agree with, but at this point, looking back, I just see, wow, these are good people, and they helped raise me, so I feel grateful.
So you had some push factors, at least, that were making you want to get out of Asheville, get out of North Carolina, and that might have been have to do with the leaking roof that you mentioned in your house, and the hard times that you allude to. Were there pull factors too that you might have gotten from doing things like reading newspapers and other signals of an outside world that you wanted to immerse yourself in?
Well, I think that's a good question. Wow, you just asked really good questions. Of course, we didn't have the internet or any of that kind of stuff, you know? So I didn't really know so much what the outside world was. However, I would say, really, this wasn't so much a pull factor, it's really another push factor, but it ended up taking me in good directions. My father, bless his heart, when his family lost their money, and that's a whole nother story, and it's a bunch of different convoluted things that happen, combination of depression, alcoholism, all kinds of other stuff. But when he was 17 years old, he lied about his age, enlisted in the Army Air Corps, went on to World War II, then went to the Korean War, then went to the Vietnam War. He was in Vietnam way before it became a full-blown war. He was there when the CIA was there. Really bad things happened to him. My father became a very, I think he had post-traumatic stress disorder, but we didn't have a term for it. And he was very abusive to his family through a period of time. Just happened to coincide with my teenage years. And so, in my case, I left home when I was 15. I've been on my own since I was 15. So when I went to high school, I wasn't living at home. I was living with other families. I just, you know, and what ended up happening even from a young age, because my dad was in the Air Force, is we had that sense of being anchored to North Carolina, but we also had to move around for certain periods of time while he was deployed. And they didn't even call it deploy. They didn't use this terminology they use now. He's just, your father's in Vietnam. I remember that I was 8 years old. This was in 1963. This is when President Kennedy was shot. Nobody even knew where Vietnam was then. Seriously, I had to kind of explain to my friends. And I lived in various places at that time, always going to Catholic schools. And because at that point, my family could afford that. And that was very, very interesting. Even though I had this anchored sense of place, North Carolina is my home, for a period of time until I was in high school, when my father retired from the Air Force and really became a major alcoholic. And then recovered from that later, but that's another story. I was exposed to really interesting people because we moved around. So I have this memory, for example, when we were based at an Air Force base in Tennessee, meeting these folks from India, meeting folks from Japan. I don't even know all the details about this, but even, you know, when I was a little girl, I remember it just seemed really normal to me to get out a map or to, just look at the world and look at where places are and kind of, you know, be interested in maybe eventually going to those places. I don't know, you know, so maybe that's a little bit of a pull factor, but I can't remember anybody saying, oh, at some point you're going to become very interested in politics and you're going to become an activist. I think that more, if that came from anything, it probably is more driven by the fact that from an early age I was so conscious, without having the vocabulary to name it, of class and inequalities, social inequalities, and the sense of how unfair that was. You know, it wasn't because somebody was inherently inferior to somebody else. It's just there are conditions that can be created by human beings and by circumstances in life that can render a whole family or a whole community or a whole society's day-to-day existence, render it into something that's very difficult. And I, you know, that is what helped to shape who I am, I think. Yeah. But I wouldn't have been able to name that at the time. Right. You know, it's just, I know that when I was a teenager and when I was at college, well, of course, also it has to do with the timing of when I went to college. Because
right.
I went to college in 73, and that was, the war was still going on in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was the early 70s, but everybody says, you know, that the 60s were extended into the 70s.
Yeah.
And I think that that's true. And so it was just, it was quite natural to be drawn towards political engagement and, you know, wanting to rock the boat a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it just fit right in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Did you... Were you already taking photos when you arrived at Carolina?
No, but it's interesting that my father was a gifted photographer, just a hobby, and had taken tons of pictures of his family and tons of pictures of places where he traveled. And so we grew up being surrounded by cameras. My father just passed away a couple of years ago, but when he died, we assembled his vast camera collection, and just of the really amazing cameras, not even the tiny little cameras. We documented 143 cameras. We have them on display. But I was surrounded by photos and by people taking pictures all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't consciously, I never at any point said, oh yeah, I'm interested in photography. But at a certain point I took two courses, and I took them in the same semester. It's really kind of funny. I took a photojournalism course with this guy, Rich Beckman, who started the photojournalism program at UNC, and then he left at some point. I don't know when. I've lost touch with him, but he went on to, I think, Miami or University of Miami or something, and he's been gone now from UNC for a while. But he was very gifted, young, ambitious, and believed only in teaching seminar style.
Hmm.
And he was just such a gifted teacher that even though I didn't realize I was interested in photography, I became deeply interested in photography. And back in the day, of course, this is pre-digital and everything, so we had to, you know, develop our own film and do all our own printing and everything, but that was part of the what made it really very captivating and fun. And then that same semester I met Alex Harris, who went on to start the Center for Documentary Studies with other folks here at Duke, but he was teaching a course at UNC. And so I took both, I had courses with both these gentlemen the same semester, and that, boom. And my memory is that was also the same semester that I was taking Jackie Hall's class, and she started doing her oral history project in Bynum. just as the textile mill there was closing down, and it was clear that the mill village hadn't started being gentrified at all yet. All the folks that had been working in the textile mill were still living there, but it was clear that their livelihood was gone and that things were going to change. You know, it took another, like, I don't know, probably like 15, 20 years before it turned over, and that's a whole nother story. But anyway, that was, so it was one of these things, at the time, I didn't, again, this is all these things you start to see in hindsight, but at the time, it just felt like, oh, they're these cool things, they all kind of go together, don't they? It's different dimensions of the same thing, and they're all kind of reinforcing each other. But I had no idea that this was going to end up adding up to a career for me.
Right.
It was just fun, you know?
And so did you do it mainly for fun, or did you ever take photos in a sort of formal way, say for the Daily Tar Heel or another student publication?
No, I wasn't even interested in that, no. I was never interested in photojournalism from a photojournalism standpoint. I was more drawn to it for the deeper kind of window into conditions that then I would want to do something about, mobilize people to do something about from a political standpoint, if that makes sense.
Sure. So, I mean, it sounds like you saw and maybe still see photography work as very explicitly activist work.
Yes, I did see it at the time that way. I actually have not been. Here's another irony. I mean, I was a photographer for a number of years, and I made my living as a photographer pretty much through my 20s and early 30s. But I never called myself a photographer, really. I didn't think of that as being my profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a very organized person, and I believe in following the energy, you know, the aliveness of something. So when opportunities come my way, and it really makes sense, I will take it and embrace it and let it go somewhere, and, you know, take it somewhere that's pretty strategic. So I'm not a person that just kind of like floats along, but at no point did I say, yes, I will be a photographer and I will be devoted to activism. At no point did I do that. I just was interested in these conditions I was encountering, interested more and more beginning to have a vocabulary for, you know, politics and political engagement and structural change and fighting and locating purpose and working with other folks, and in a way, I mean, it makes so much sense that I'm doing now what I'm doing here at Duke that I've been doing now for 20 years, but at no point did I say, I am a photographer, this is who I am. I just didn't think of it that way. It was just a beautiful tool, almost really just a hobby. I thought of it as a hobby that paid my living, but the larger work was this work of changing structures in society, and I'm not even interested in photography right now. Isn't that fascinating? But I wasn't a dilettante. It's just,
right.
It's kind of fun. I haven't talked about all this stuff in a long, long time. I have a very visual sense. But photography always was just a tool to, a way of seeing something intensely and then bringing it to other folks, hopefully helping them to see it. And then the conversation that comes from that. It was always the conversation that then leads to action that I was interested in.
Well, it's a very liberating way of thinking about living, I think, generally. Just to consider that you could be very deeply into something for a decade and move on. Itself, to realize that is, I think when you're young, you expect that at some point you'll choose your career.
Yeah, right.
And it's nice to think that you might be able to choose more than one along the way.
Yeah, right. Well, that's honestly, my students now, bless their hearts, they have so much more pressure on them to have it all figured out, you know, when they're junior high school, or they don't even call it junior high school, middle school? It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I love my students. They're not crazy. It's just they've got all these pressures from everybody, sometimes from their parents, certainly just from society. And I wouldn't have known. Isn't that amazing that I spend a lot of my coaching, mentoring with students, like, okay, you're dealing, negotiate this pressure because it's real. If you can, move in the direction of honoring that voice that says, I'm doing this because I want to. Because for whatever reason, that was always very strong with me. And then at a certain point, you realize, wow, this thing then opened up to that thing, and that opened up to that thing. And each thing, the next step, is can actually end up being way more powerful, way more beneficial, and actually way more kind of integrated than if you had planned it all out. It's right. Amazing.
Right.
You know?
So you you graduate from Carolina maybe in 77 or 78?
No, actually, I took 2 years off. I graduated in 1980.
Okay.
So I dropped out of college after my sophomore year for a couple of years because I just really couldn't really see. I actually was an English major. I loved it, but I couldn't really see where it was going. And during those 2 years, I worked for this little publication called The Sun,
yeah.
which is still around.
Yeah, yeah.
But back in those days, it was Cy Safransky, the gentleman who started that publication, was selling The Sun on the street in front of what used to be called the Carolina Coffee Shop. I'm sure it's long since.
Is it still there?
Oh my gosh. Okay. That's funny. And it was just this really funky little publication. And so I got a job working at what eventually became the Pie Wacket Cafe. It had a different name back in those days. And I worked there during the daytime, or during at night, and during the day I worked for Cy Safransky.
Mm-hmm.
I was the assistant director of The Sun, which is, I laugh, because, I mean, God bless it, it's a wonderful publication, but I just, it's kind of funny how then that he took me very seriously. He was a wonderful mentor. I didn't do any photography. I just did writing and helping him edit stories, but it was a really interesting education. It helped to pave the way to my wanting to go back to school and to go into journalism.
And The Sun, now it mingles art and
yeah.
literary material with sort of opinion pieces and other
right.
stuff. Was it
That's right.
the same thing then?
No, it was much more of a, it was trying to figure out what it was. It was much more of a spiritual kind of, I don't know what, it was like, I don't even know how to describe what it was. It was Cy's spiritual journal,
mm-hmm.
and you
mm-hmm.
know, or I don't know if I might want to edit that part out,
because
okay. I don't know that I want everybody to know I said that. To be honest, it wasn't quite sure what it wanted to be yet,
mm-hmm.
and it took a while for it to really take shape, but it was Cy reflecting on deeper spiritual questions and issues, and it was. Definitely tied in with people taking LSD, okay?
So speaking of connections, was this an opportunity for you to meet people who were doing journalism or other kinds of work in the area?
No, no.
Mm-hmm.
These were just people living their lives. These were, you know, good-hearted people who were midwives or writers or people, you know, doing some small-scale farming and stuff. This is a whole subculture.
Mm-hmm.
It was nothing about professional journalists or any of that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff. The Sun's gotten a lot more sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
you know, since those early days.
This definitely would have been, I mean, part of a subculture that was emergent during and after the 60s of people sort of trying to find another path
mm-hmm.
to fulfillment of some kind.
Everybody was doing that, though.
Yeah.
This is way before you were born, so you don't remember. This is the norm, my friend. This is just a given. You know, you would try. I mean, I was just completely normal in my, you know, cohort. Everybody
mm-hmm.
was just. We knew we would get jobs somehow, but everybody was on a, you know, trying to figure out why are we here on the earth, and
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
so they were asking those other questions. I mean, in hindsight, I kind of laugh because I was just so young, and I do respect the me that was doing that, but I think I had to have that time to think and to go inside more deeply. And actually, in a way, I think of it in hindsight now as a fallow period. I was active, but it's a fallow period in terms of. I discovered a lot of wonderful resources you know, and creative tools and resilience and ways of living on my own and all kinds of stuff that ended up being very important in my life. But on the face of it, it seemed like 2 years when I was hanging around with a bunch of hippies producing a little rag that had a spiritual bent to it, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So, but people weren't saying, oh, and now where are you headed with your career? That question didn't come up.
Right.
You know?
So, after your work at The Sun, you returned to Carolina and you've changed your major from English to journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And you graduated in 1980?
Mm-hmm.
And where to from there?
Oh, well, okay, so the first thing I did was I got a job with migrant farm workers. Mm-hmm. And again, it's one of those things where I asked myself, I've always given myself permission to ask, what do I want to do? If there's something that's drawing me and it's really strong, I want to go investigate it. And I'm a very curious person. And I really wanted to go work with migrant farm workers in eastern North Carolina. I couldn't even totally explain why, but it just kept coming at me from lots of different directions. Back in those days, there were very few Latinos on the eastern stream, what they call the migrant stream. It was mainly African-American men, some Haitians, because people coming over as what they call boat people, and it was connected to U.S. policy, and it was very, very strange thing. But we had Cuban boat people and Haitian, but the Haitians started coming in before all the Cubans, is a whole other story. But we got folks dumped on the migrant stream who were horribly, horribly abused. I didn't know any of this until I got involved with this federal organization, and that now, oh gosh, I can't remember the name. They changed the name, but it's still around, and it provides kind of very basic services to migrants in the field. Like, we'll bring you to a health clinic when things are very desperate. It's not solving the situation, but it gives you. So my job was to work with this organ. It was called the Migrant Seasonal Farm Workers Association. It was funded by federal government money. And I basically functioned as a social worker. And I did that for a year. I would bring people to health clinics. I would bring them to legal aid sometimes when I could get access to them if they were trying to contest not being paid, you know, or sometimes I would go and visit and talk to the farmers. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. But it was an amazing year, and I lived in Smithfield, and I lived in a little garage apartment back behind a family, very salt of the earth, kind of conservative, politically conservative family, really good people. Southern Baptist people, and they thought what I was doing was very odd, but I was very safe living in downtown Smithfield. But then going out into Johnson County, Harnett County, Sampson County in the daytime, visiting farms, sometimes getting met at the gate with a loaded shotgun by the farmer, telling me it was his private property and I needed to leave. And I would be very polite and say, but I work with the Migrant Seasonal Farm Workers Organization, a federal agency, and I do have a right to inspect your farm, inspect the conditions of the migrant farm workers. And so sometimes they would let me come on, but they were not really very pleasant. But it's interesting, they weren't, I felt, these are my people. They look like my grandfather. I was probably related to some of them. And so, you know, some of them I could charm and talk to, and we'd have a lot of people were perfectly wonderful to me, and because they saw me and my group that I worked with as being somewhat helpful. We could take people to the clinic, bring them back, help them get food stamps sometimes to supplement the times when they weren't working in the field, stuff like that. But sometimes it was quite difficult. Early on, I went into a field of Haitian workers who had a Haitian boss who also couldn't speak very much English, but enough to deal with the farmer. But what astounded me about the Haitians was that they had no shoes, they had some of them had no, a majority of them had no shirts on, and they were out topping and suckering tobacco leaves. Do you know enough about tobacco? You know, that was back in the day when we grew a lot of tobacco here in North Carolina, and that is very sticky, ugly, hot, difficult, horrible work. And these men were out there in the field, and they had open sores on their backs and on their feet. I was just so disgusted and astounded by that and upset. And I even knew what I was getting into. I wasn't even naive about what I was getting into, right? That was so upsetting. I came back. You're bringing out things I haven't thought about in years. I came back to, so I had a boyfriend at UNC. Okay, so I came back and was very upset, and I told my boyfriend, I'm going to go to this church that's right around the corner from where we lived, and I'm going to tell them about this, and I'm going to see if they can help, because something's got to be done. And so the thing that upset me was that the men couldn't speak English, and I knew a little bit of French, so I communicated with them, but there was virtually nobody who could communicate with them, and that was very upsetting. So my idea, it's naive in hindsight, but I thought, if we could just get them English classes during these times when they're not able to go out into the field, even that, then let's work on the conditions, let's work on this, let's work on that. Okay, so I went to this church. I went up in front of the church on a Sunday. It was an African-American church right around the corner from where we live. They asked me to come down. I stood in front of the whole congregation. I told my story. Tears started streaming down my face. I felt so surrounded by love. People took a collection. I didn't ask them to do this. We raised $183. I remember that amount. The minister and I together planned this idea of setting up connection with a community college where this guy would come and teach English, and we were going to pay him to do this. And when the time came to do it, he didn't show up. That's a whole nother story. That was a disaster. Mm. But it taught me so many things all at once. The thing, if you see something, you reach out. In hindsight, why did I go to a black church? Why did I do this? I don't know. It doesn't all make sense, but it actually, everything kind of flowed, and it also taught me a lot. And we ended up channeling the $183 into, we weren't able to do, the migrants moved on, I don't know. But we channeled it, we gave it to some organization that was working with migrant farm workers, and then I moved on to the next thing when that year ended. But it was very intense. Oh, the other thing I did was I collected, now I work with Bob Hall, who used to be married to Jackie Hall, and he was running Southern Exposure magazine. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, Bob, I'm working with Martin Gonzalez. There are only a few Latinos on the stream, but he has access to them. I have access to these other guys. We want to do a series of interviews. We want to document what's going on in Eastern North Carolina in this region in these three counties. We want to do some oral history interviews. I want to be able to take some photos. I can't do like front photo, you know, facial, but I can do some Would you be interested in a little expose? You know, yeah, we've done exposés on migrant farm workers. It needs to be different. What are you going to do? What's your angle? Blah, blah, blah. So I spent a whole year collecting all these interviews. I think I did 27 or 28 interviews. When somebody was getting sent back to Immokalee, Florida, because the season was over, I built up a relationship with them. I had my little tape recorder. I'd say, I'm not going to use your name if you don't want me to, of course. I would recommend we probably not use it. I could use other initials, or we could make something up or whatever. But I did basically a little mini oral history interview with them. And sometimes we'd have an hour and a half while we were waiting for the Greyhound bus to come pick them up to take them back to Immokalee, Florida. And so it was all men. And I painstakingly collected all these interviews. I transcribed them. We thought about it. Martin did his. We compared notes. We met with Bob. We came up with this article. I don't even know. I probably have it at home buried somewhere in a chest. And we published this article in Southern Exposure magazine. And that was my kind of trying to pull it together, at least in some way, that tried to do some justice to that very intensive year. But where it really ended up feeding me, and this is in hindsight, is it informs what I do in my own program right now. But that's a whole nother story. We can get to that in a minute.
So, instead of curiosity, how did you know to go to Bob Hall and Southern Exposure? Were you a reader?
Well, no, I knew Bob Well, I think at that point, Bob was already starting to ask me to do some freelance photography. Bit by bit, this is the part I don't remember all the chronology really well, but I found that folks started calling me up, can you go do this story? Can you do that story? And it kind of began to take shape organically. And Bob had already asked me to do a couple stories about some other stuff. And so I was starting to get to know him. He and Jackie, I think, had already split up at that point, or I don't really remember. I don't remember all the chronology, but I think, you know, they were still friends. They were very cordial. And I had met him before, because when we were doing the story on Bynum, literally, I didn't have a car. Jackie got Bob to let me borrow his car so I could drive from Chapel Hill to Bynum to interview the people in the mill village. So back in those days, folks that were doing this kind of work all knew each other. Right. It was a small little group, small universe. And I just thought he was just such as, I just admired him, respected him. He was a man of few words, probably still is. But I just felt there was real resonance, and that I was younger than he, but he just respected me. I was kind of unformed. He's just like, go do it. And I really like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it wasn't more complicated than that. But when I do remember when I republished the article, I thought I had enough presence of mind at that point to know this is just nothing. It's wonderful. I've put a little cap here on the end of my experience, but nothing's changed. This is way larger than this tiny little thing that I've done. And these forces are huge, and they're deeply ingrained in a way of life, and it's a culture, and it's a way of doing business, and this is not going to change overnight, and it's so complicated, and yet I wasn't discouraged at all. It was a feeling of empowerment, man. Like, you go do the thing, and things open up. Really, and I try to help my students see that. It's just, I call it the organic progression of the work. And the term I use is trust the organic progression of the work. And what I tell them is, if you go deeply into a context and you're really curious and you're open and you listen and you start to make connections and you start to build relationships and you continue to be driven by curiosity, you're going to be ruined in a good way for life, because it's going to keep drawing you more and more into the direction of becoming political and more sophisticated about how you go about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the major thing that came from that year for me. I model the Heart Fellows program in a lot of ways after what happened during that year, because there's so many important dimensions. Learning how to read a very complex context as best as you can from your limited vantage point, testing out what you're seeing with a lot of other vantage points and perspectives, learning how to work with conflict in a skillful way, seeing conflict as a resource, and learning how to work with it as skillfully as you can given who you are. At no point did I lose my integrity about who I was with those farmers, and I identify with them. These are my people. I could feel that little voice saying, these are your people. And yet at the same time, I was very clear about what I was there for, what my purpose was. If they tried to give me a hard time, I was respectful, but I didn't give up, give in, any of that kind of stuff, you know? I learned when to be appropriately confrontational, when not to be, when to see your larger battle is somewhere else after this story has ended. Mm-hmm. It moves on to the next thing. So it kind of helped me, the whole critical reflection process going off after you've had the intensive experience and letting it settle so you can figure out the deeper meaning, you can figure out the deeper structural issues, the deeper political issues, what is it connected to. It helped me become much more strategic, you know, over time. Just the pure fun of the work is really fun, you know?
Yeah.
I know it sounds strange to say that, because it's dealing with really difficult human conditions that are very, very upsetting to very disturbing to have knowledge of, especially when you don't immediately see what you can do to change it.
Right.
And even just seeing that this is so much bigger than I am, how could I have the illusion that I can change it? But over time, things could change. And so just being really intrigued by that whole question of how change does happen and the collective nature of change and the long-term view, all that stuff started being formed that year. Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting you mentioned that, because one of the things that I wonder a lot about the kind of work that The Independent was doing in the early 80s, for instance, and the kind of work that that Bob Hall and Southern Exposure were doing and continue to do, is sort of how to measure success.
Yeah.
And those bigger questions too apply, I think, to activism generally. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can think about what happened in the 1960s as, you know, the most profound revolution in the United States since the revolution.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And yet, we look around and we see that racial inequality persists and poverty persists and these questions are in some ways are more pressing than ever with issues of migrant labor and migrant families are in the news these days.
Yes.
And so we can and should rightly celebrate the progress we've made. And if that's, I mean, at celebrate might not be the right word, but I think you'll take my meaning. And yet we look around and we see so much more fixing that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And so, from a personal perspective, I think thinking of that organic development is a really good way to not be discouraged at the smallness of the self in that big picture. And I'm also just trying to get my head around the impact of this kind of work. And speaking with people who've done it, it's so profound to them on their lives. And the work that they've done has had an impact. But how do we measure that?
Yeah. Well, are you talking about measuring it from the personal, you're talking about measuring it on a societal level, a social efficacy or political change is what you're talking about?
Sort of both. I mean, the short answer is I don't know. How do we do it? It's unfair to ask someone who's worked for social change, well,
what's
your score?
At
the same time, we're talking about the real world and real impact on real people's lives.
Right.
One of those people is the person themselves.
Right.
But the others are, there are many, many others.
Yeah.
It's really an open-ended question, and I don't know that it has an answer. It's just, I'm just sort of sharing a wonderment about how you begin to think about measuring your effectiveness as an advocate for change, the effectiveness of an organization, the effectiveness of a movement.
Right.
And where do you sort of draw the timeline? Some of the gains of the Voting Rights Act have been sort of recently reversed. Now, does that mean that the action in the 60s that accomplished the act in the first place, should we now render that less successful than it was in just 5 years ago? Or when do we stop measuring? There's a whole clump of questions I've just dumped on the table like a pile of old toys, and I'm not really...
But those questions are, they're so important. It's interesting. It's a paradox because, of course, the question of your effectiveness, to me, it would be your political effectiveness, your strategic savvy, you know, learning how to mobilize people, mobilize groups of really skillful, talented, focused people, passionate people. You're mobilizing them. You're not directing them. You're doing your part to help create a, you know, I use this term a lot in my teaching, a holding environment. It's a very creative environment where people can learn how to be present to themselves and to what's happening in their society. You know, the society that they are, that they identify as being the most connected in trying to, you know, work with, make better. Or, you know what, another word I'm using a lot these days is locating that group or that context that you want to do your part to help it thrive. You want to do your part to help it flourish, you know, because it already is alive, but what can you do to help it flourish even more, you know? And so asking that question about efficacy is really, really important. That's a hugely important question. And at the same time, it's got to be tied in creating a holding environment. A holding environment is like creating the sort of the parameters for I'm working on this now, and by gosh, I feel really committed to being as wide awake right now, working with these good people, doing the best I can right now on this, with a strategic viewpoint. You know, it's like we want to change these structures and we want to change these systems, and these are the hardcore politics of it. But that also it's connected to your own self and your own growth and your own sense of purpose and your own, your own ability to be present. I mean, so to me, the question about efficacy always comes back to the question of how awake am I, and how awake can I be with this group of people? And I know that sounds strange. I am not a New Age person. But I think that's a political question. I really do. I think it's a fundamentally political question about choosing to open your eyes and to be as to try to minimize the distractions, cut through to the essence of something, commit yourself to be there and to be awake, and to widen that circle of being with other people who are awake. And that, to me, that's where the juicy stuff is, because it can take off in ways that if you had planned and planned and planned for months and years, you never would have expected. You don't know. You're not in control of that. It's not up to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I would measure the efficacy more along how awake are you?
Yeah.
What's your level of commitment and how awake are you? And I would also measure it, quite frankly, with how much fun are you having as you're doing this? Because this is such serious work and so important that the paradox, it's a lot of paradoxes, is you got to just relax and enjoy. It's got to be enjoyable, or why the heck would anybody want to do it, and how could it sustain itself over time, and how can you sustain yourself? Do you know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's more, maybe it's just because I'm getting older, but I think it's all about that. It's all about being present, and that the efficacy comes from that, and the joy comes from that.
Hmm.
And I would say the power comes from that, and certainly the human connection comes from that. It all comes from that.
Yeah.
And it's really hard.
Yeah. Well, I think the intersection of hard work and joyfulness is probably a pretty good place to be. It seemed, at least from what I've learned from people who are working at the Independent in its early days, that there was certainly a lot of hard work. Some joy, at least.
Oh, there was a lot of joy. It was fun.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
So how did you end up there? So the Independent puts out its first issue fairly early in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some planning and efforts that go into that, certainly. A great deal of planning, a great deal of effort.
Right.
But you were one of the first staff members at the publication.
I was the third staff member. I was on the staff before Catherine Fulton was hired, the editor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just before. I mean, Steve Shule, David Burkhead, me, and then Catherine Fulton, and then we kind of filled it out with everybody else.
Steve and David hire you? Or what
Steve
was
Steve hired
Steve
me.
Steve hired you, okay.
So Steve and David were friends, and I didn't know David. I don't even remember exactly how Steve and I met each other, but folks had been telling me about Steve. Other people have been telling Steve about me as a photographer, but I'd been hearing about him because he'd been involved with politics, you know. And so, and I was involved with politics, and that's a whole other story. There are so many different stories, you know. When you get to be older, you just have a million stories. But anyway, we were in two different circles. I was over in Chapel Hill. I was with all the little, you know, political people connected to the history department in Chapel Hill. And Steve was over here with all the Duke people. But there was some overlap. And at one point, we just got together and we just hit it off. We hit it off. We got together very intentionally with the purpose of just checking out would I be a good fit to do some photography with this little, we didn't even call itself a newspaper yet. We didn't know what it was going to be, a statewide publication of some kind. And he drafted this prospectus. I remember we went off to Southern Pines or someplace, Pinehurst, where Catherine's family had a little condo, and we just kind of holed ourselves up. At that point, I think there were seven of us, and we just had a very intensive planning weekend or retreat of some kind. And then I think the initial idea was I was going to be a halftime photographer, and then, but I, you know, I said to Steve, it's crazy, this is definitely a full-time job. I shudder to think, this is so funny, we were so young, we were going to cover the whole state, be a bi-weekly statewide publication, and, you know, we just had that tiny little staff. But it was just very fun. One thing led to another. When Steve and I met each other, we just clicked. Great chemistry from the beginning, one of those mysterious things. Same with Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Knight, she's just a great lady. I assume you've talked to Catherine.
I haven't. I'd like to get out to, she's out on the West Coast.
Right.
And so, you know, a phone call or a trip or an order at some point. So.
Oh, she's fabulous. But no, we had a lot of fun. I mean, it was, oh gosh, I mean, it was just, we were in these tiny, tiny little offices. Have you seen pictures of it or heard people talk about it? And one of my memories is that you just had to be a good sport about this, but you know, our bathroom was our dark room. And so when people had to come to use the bathroom, I had to get out of the dark room. And it was crazy, but it was fun. It was exciting, and it was one of the best things I've ever done, really.
Do you remember any of your, well, I suppose before I ask that, I should ask if you remember how your assignments emerged. You would eventually become, or maybe fairly quickly, become the photo editor and the head photographer.
Right.
So were you making your own decisions about what to shoot, or was that coming from the editors or the publisher? Or where did that sort of hierarchy work?
That's a really interesting question. My memory of it is that we did a lot of group planning. I mean, it's one of those funny things you look back on and you think, how on earth did we function? But we had, you know, that was just also part of the culture of the day, is that, you know, you plan everything by group. I mean, that's one of the nice things about bringing Catherine along, because she was very respectful. And when we hired Catherine, when Steve hired Catherine, she's deeply respectful of, you know, group input and all that kind of stuff, but she's not afraid of authority, man. She'd been running a paper. It's like, okay, we're going to do this. Come on, we got a deadline. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really liked that from the start. And but we'd generate story ideas together. We were all kind of, that was a benefit of all being together in such a small space. There was a lot of cross-fertilization of ideas. So sometimes, yeah, I would come up with ideas, but oftentimes it was just something, we kick around ideas, people would tear it apart, we did a lot of fighting in a good way, you know, to just like, no, I don't know about that, you know, this would probably work better. That was part of the aliveness of the whole venture too. You weren't doing this for yourself, it was larger than you. But the trade-off was, you know, ridiculous amount of time talking.
Right. It's a little bit arcane, but it just popped into my head. I guess I'm thinking of the kinds of issues that The Independent was working on, and there's a lot of emphasis on the environment.
Even in the early publications?
Yeah, I mean, one of the early pieces was on the Armageddon.
Oh, right. Well, that's the very first issue.
Yeah. And this is just a question for someone who's worked in photography. I'm thinking that we're sitting here, and you have here on the table in front of us a picture of Governor Jim Martin and Catfish Hunter, and I'm thinking of how dynamic this photograph is, and thinking of how challenging it must be to attempt to pair a photo with environmental reporting, because of the lack of, potentially the lack of people.
Right. I don't remember that we did a lot of environmental reporting.
Okay.
That's not my or at least when I was there. I was just there for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my memory. I certainly don't remember taking pictures of that. All my pictures were, you know, people pictures.
So what were the kinds of photos you were taking?
But, I mean, even the Armageddon photo, the photo was a picture of a big question mark on top of a drum. You know, it was like a steel drum that had what? And, you know, in fact, a lot of the steel drums had question marks on them, and they were, you know, there were chemicals in them. And so that was actually what caught our attention was the visuals. That was by... Those drums were stacked up, and there was a vast kind of, I don't know, field of drums, such drums, and it was right by the freeway.
Mm.
And so you would drive by, and you see these rotting, rusting drums with that you knew that was a chemical storage place, and you just saw these big, bold question marks. Do you see?
Yeah.
I don't even remember the details of the story, but I do remember when I took the picture, my memory is I had to, like, you know, put my camera and take the picture through a chain link fence. Obviously, mm-hmm. We weren't allowed on the property.
Right.
But most of my pictures were of people. What was your question?
I was just thinking of some of those assignments or some of those projects. When you were taking those photos of people, what were the kinds of, do you remember anything from those moments or those stories?
You know, that's the thing that I wish I had more time to kind of look at some of these, you know, we took all kinds of, I mean, we went mm-hmm. to a debutante ball. I'm looking at this one, right? We were interested in politics and culture. Okay, you
right,
know, so
right.
I mean, I think we called ourselves the statewide newspaper of politics and culture or something like that. And so, you know, I'm looking right now, I'm flipping through some of these old issues. I remember going to I've referenced Southern Baptist about 3 or 4 times already in this interview. And one time, Steve and I went to the Baptist convention.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, they have it in different places. They had it up in Asheville. It was in the Civic Center in Asheville. I think they just finished building the Civic Center. It just seemed vast to me. It was, you know, it was really fascinating because, in a way, these were my people. These are my people. And yet I remember thinking, wow, this isn't my culture either. And so, and there are hundreds of these good folks here. And here I am, you know, a little old hippie. And wow, these are two different cultures here. And I'm a photographer, and how am I going to take pictures of these good folks?
Mm-hmm.
And so that started being born in me, that whole thing of what I call the right way of approach, so that you don't spend too much time trying to explain who you are and what you're doing, but you spend enough, you get have enough of a core relationship going that you can actually enter into a dialogue of sorts with the person, so that you, when you take the picture, it's not some stilted thing. It's something that has a kind of a flow and an energy to it, and
mm-hmm.
it's being respectful of the person, but it's also revealing something interesting about that moment. And that was challenging to me. But I liked the fact, even flipping through these, that we would go, you know, from visiting the governor on this big farm in Hertford, yeah,
mm-hmm.
To the debutante ball. That was like going into a whole other culture for me, too. That was really actually very interesting. And, you know, just there was something new and different about that. Every week there was a new and different assignment, and I was working with a network of photographers across the state. I couldn't pay them very much, but these were basically my friends. If I didn't know them, we became friends, and they were interested in the idea of the independent, and I loved the creativity of how ideas emerged, and I loved the creativity of trying to figure out how to come working against deadline, come up with decent, good photos, compelling photos with a budget of almost nothing. How do you do that? And so, you know, I thought the undercurrent of everything we did was political, but you didn't overtly say that to everybody,
right.
But it just felt that way. So it was
right.
very, it's very exciting.
Well, I'm curious about that idea. I guess let me put it this way. There's a conception or a misconception
mm-hmm.
that journalism is quote unquote objective.
In
the same way that scholarship, historical scholarship, is objective. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's balanced, or you tell both sides of the story, or you don't,
yeah.
you know, you don't have bias or whatever that is.
Yeah.
This was not a newspaper that labored under that misapprehension.
Right. Right.
And it doesn't sound like you particularly subscribe to that idea either. Can you talk a little bit more about it, sort of how you saw your work fitting into to a sort of something that had a political agenda, not an insidious agenda,
yeah.
but
mm-hmm.
but had a point. The point
mm-hmm.
was more than a sort of flat representation of a moment in time, and there was a story to tell that had an end game.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny, because we started the Independent such a long time ago. Now that I look back on it, I feel we were, I mean, I'm not blaming us, but I feel I was naive, and we were all naive, and we were classic liberal leftist, university privileged young people. What's wrong with that? Nothing. Nothing's wrong. our hearts were in the right place. A lot of us were actually from North Carolina or had long-term North Carolina ties. We were smart, you know, we weren't idiots. I mean, we were disciplined, we were hardworking, but we were very naive about what we were, where this was all going to lead ultimately. And at this point, I mean, I try to teach my students, or at least expose them to something that's much more nuanced, because I think it's more effective. I think, if anything, we were just too shrill, too much in the leftist kind of direction, and that we probably, you know, I try to teach my students that I think where the interesting, our country right now is just so polarized, that the interesting work is not tolerating some other perspective, but really engaging with it when it is just completely different from yours. And having full respect that it is, but yet you share this problem together, and by gosh, you've got to get to the point where you're being practical about how you're going to tackle it together, you know? And without equalizing the viewpoints. That is really hard work.
Yeah.
And my memory of those early days, I don't honestly, how we couldn't have been differently than what we were. It was good. It was breath of fresh air. And, and the state needed, I think, in a way, and it sounds silly to say, but we needed something like this. But it was really very much, it wasn't about dialogue with the different perspectives. It really wasn't. It was just about shaking things up. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not minimizing it. But I just think, ultimately the work is more sophisticated than that. Okay? And and that you must have your own perspective. You must lay claim to your own perspective and be bold about it. But if ultimately you just leave it at that, we're never gonna get anywhere. That's the problem. It's a much deeper, much more demanding, much more difficult skill to, I don't know. You get what I'm saying, right?
I think I do. Absolutely. To what extent do you think, I'm thinking of 1983 as the year in which The Independent publishes its first issue and the year that CNN starts broadcasting.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Two very different styles of journalism.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think the media today or since your work at The Independent, and I'd like to return to a couple more details about that, but just following this thread a little bit, to what extent do you think the media has contributed to this polarization that we're experiencing today?
Oh, well, well, that's weird. You're not asking any easy questions today, are you?
You just don't want to bore myself, or you?
Well, you know, of course the media has contributed to it, but you can't blame it on the media. There are all kinds of other factors. It's so complicated.
And it is kind of...
It's connected with just so many deep, difficult things about our society. That's not a simple question. I know you didn't mean it as a simple question. There's no simple answer. I don't have it all worked out.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's in the interest of certain media outlets to try to probably intensify the polarization, I guess, or because that seems more dramatic. But there are other things that are working at reinforcing the polarization too. I mean, a lot of the ways in which the internet functions, where you just line up with you gravitate towards your group of people who believe what you do, rather than this thing that I'm talking about of having to truly rub up against somebody who fundamentally is another. Their politics, their culture, their way of viewing the world is fundamentally completely different from yours, and it always will be. And yet you share this reality of whatever this hugely interdependent problem is that you share, whatever it is, however you want to define it. And the need to somehow allow the different perspectives, and yet, again, I love the paradox is a term I use a lot these days, but it's real, it's not wishful thinking. Your owning the shared problem is not going to go away. And so can you reach the point where you really do deal with each other, talk to each other, engage in surprising practical work with each other to resolve the problem? media can also probably play a helpful role in reinforcing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the forces of polarization are so rampant right now. There's so many things that even the way we use our own private little, you know, social media and stuff that works against people learning these difficult political arts of truly engaging with perspectives that are not ours, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I worry about, because I feel like what we're doing in our own little program here is just, we're doing the best we can, and what we've seen when we work with students and we challenge them directly to learn, to begin to practice these arts, they love it. It's very empowering. And if we have more time to talk, I could tell you some of the things that we do in our classes and that sort of thing. But it's not a widespread kind of practice in the culture. So media is part of that, but it's lots of other things. It's just, you know, we're going to have to get together again and address that question. You've asked so many excellent questions today, and in a way I feel like that is the most important question you've asked that resonates with the work I'm doing with my students and what I see we need to do as we go forward if we're going to have any chance of getting young people really engaged in a sustained way in politics.
Right.
You know?
Well, it's an unfairly broad question, but it also sort of gets to the core question of why publications like The Independent existed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because it seems to me that people like yourself and Steve Shule and others and you know, had an agenda. There were a set of problems
yeah.
that they had identified that they wanted
yeah.
to fix. And that
yeah.
was true at The Independent, and it was true at some of these radio stations that we've been speaking to.
Yeah.
You know, all that connects into my curiosity about metrics of success and
yeah.
about agendas and politics and what
yeah.
journalism is supposed to do. And these, we'll never answer these questions, but perhaps, as you suggest, if we keep talking about it, it'll be useful.
Well, just asking the question is so helpful, though. You're very gifted at asking these questions.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I'm
yeah,
lucky to talk to
fun.
Interesting people.
This has been fun.
Well, can we just it's getting towards the end of the day, but
yeah.
Can we talk briefly about you were there from 1983 to 1986? Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
I actually started with Steve in 1982. I started before the publication.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because it took us about a year to get geared up for everything. So I don't remember exactly the timeline, but I do remember I started working with him. He hired me in 1982, and I left in 1985.
Oh, okay. 82
yeah.
to 5. Okay.
Because mm-hmm. 1985 is when I went to Mexico and then Nicaragua and El Salvador and then, you know, the whole bunch of other stuff that I'd been working on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Up until then.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious about your sort of parting of ways. What was it that, I know that you had said that from when you were an even younger person than you were
mm-hmm.
than when you were working at The Independent, you had wanted to get out and see the world.
Yeah.
And you went and did that eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember sort of how you parted ways? This wasn't a staff
yeah.
that stuck around necessarily for a really long time, so it wouldn't have been strange for you to leave.
Oh, no. It's, you know what? That's a great question. I mean, I know... we parted ways in a really nice way. I mean, because it was just, because, you know, I'm lifelong friends with Steve, and I haven't talked to Catherine in a while, but I feel like she's a lifelong friend. And, you know, I have tremendous affection for all those folks that I worked with. But what happened was my husband and I split up, and he was, this is my first husband, and he was slated to go do research in Mexico for a whole year. This is in 1985. And I actually took advantage of that sort of natural, it was a question, am I going to go with him to Latin America or am I going to stay here? And we were just, you know, just at the same time we were just about to split up. And we did split up, and then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go to Latin America on my own. He's going to go do his research where he does it in Mexico. I'm going to go to the opposite side of Mexico and learn Spanish. And then I'm going to head on down to Nicaragua and do this work that I've been involved with now for several years, which is exactly what I did. And so it was just sort of a natural, for personal reasons, a natural point, a turning point. But it was a professional turning point, too, because my energy a lot of my, and really I'm a builder. I like to come in with a group of people and create something, do it very intensely for a while, hand it off to the next generation, and then move on to the next stage for what I'm being drawn to. And I started getting involved with my Central America stuff really right around the same time. It was 1978. So all that stuff was very intense by 1985. That was right in the middle of the war. And that's a whole nother conversation. But anyway, my work with these faith communities just got more and more, became a much bigger draw to me. It was political. It was about questions of faith and purpose and sustainability and all kinds of things. Were very, always been very important to me. And that, it was just, it all kind of came together. Again, you know, trust the organic progression of the work means you read the signs, you read the opportunities, you weigh things, and if something says, come join me, even though you don't know where it's going to go, ultimately, you do it. And that, it was just a natural ending, and it made perfect sense. My memory is it made perfect sense to Catherine. She was wonderful, gracious about it. We had another young woman that I'd been grooming to take my place. She was fabulous. She happily took my place. She'd been my intern for a couple of years. They didn't miss a beat. It all worked out really well. And, you know, I just moved on to the next phase of my life.
Yeah, good. Yeah. So just one more question before we wrap up. I was thinking about how you're a North Carolina person with this North Carolina family.
Yeah.
Ties to the Southern Baptist community, although, as you said, your family was Catholic.
My family on my grandmother's side, but my grandfather was Southern Baptist. He was converted to Catholicism.
Okay. Yeah. So in some ways, very much embedded in the state.
Yeah.
And yet you had these encounters maybe activist may not be the right word when you're working for the federal government, but with the migrant program and then as a photographer, when you are taking on the role of outsider.
Right.
Really, and are, mm-hmm. you know, in some sense, it's being perceived as hostile to the interests of the state.
Yeah, yeah.
Did that ever get weird for you?
You know, that's such a... Wow! Do you ask amazing questions, young man? You really do. That is a fabulous question. It got weird in a good way. It was interesting. I realized, in fact, that was a power that I had. Mm-hmm. That I always have been the outsider who is the insider. That's a huge power. It's a huge power. It's a huge personal power. It's a huge political power. You know? I was so young, I didn't... This is another insight that's really become much more clear as I've gotten older. But even when I was young, I realized, I can do this. You know, even to go back to the thing about the farmer, this is my person. I am... We are one here. You know, we're from the same folks. And yet... I didn't agree with what was being done. I didn't agree with the circumstances, and yet I knew I had the right. I also had the Southern charm. I had everything, you know. I had the sense of humor. I had, you know, I had the persistence. I had the stubbornness. I had all kinds of things I could be the insider who is challenging things coming at it from the outside. So it's an insider from a belonging standpoint, but an outsider from a practical standpoint for how I grew up and, you know, all that kind of stuff, where I was able to have some perspective that allowed me to ask those questions, those charged questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it's pretty much been true in everything I've ever done. It's what I teach my students how to do, the power of the question that comes from an outside perspective, because going out to the outside lets you look in and see things in a fresh way. And yet, you don't have the right, in a way, to ask it unless you really understand or somehow are related to what's going on the inside. So if you're not naturally related to it, get related to it. Because it's just, I think, it's very ineffective, talking about efficacy, to just shrilly lob questions from the outside without contextualizing in a relationship what's really going on the inside. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so, yeah. Wow. You rock.
Well, thank you. You rock. Maybe we should just end there.
Okay. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Okay. You are so good at asking questions, man.
Oh, you're very kind. You're very
kind. I'm not trying to be kind. You really, really are. Where does the... That's a gift.
Thank you. Well, I have to say, it describes